Jim Leach served our state as a U.S. congressman for 30 years with his wealth of expertise on international relations. This hour, his view of the global challenges facing the next president. River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Jim Leach will share his views on how U.S. relations with Russia have changed and the threat of Vladimir Putin reclaiming control of former Soviet bloc states. We'll also talk about Trump's questioning of the One China policy, his opposition to the Iran nuclear deal, and also have Jim Leach reflect on the tumultuous 2016 campaign and election and what it means for the state of our democracy. A conversation with Jim Leach. First, this hour's news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this hour is former Congressman Jim Leach. Leach served 30 years from 1977 to 2007 as a Republican member of the U.S. House of Representatives from Iowa. Following that, he served several years as chair of the National Endowment for the Humanities. That was from 2009 to 2013. He also served on the faculty at Harvard and at Princeton. Currently, he's chair in public affairs, also visiting professor of law and senior scholar at the University of Iowa, and also interim director of the University of Iowa Museum of Art. Congressman Leach, what a pleasure to have you back in our studio. Thank you for joining us.
Honored to be with you again, Ben.
Today, over the noon hour, Leach is the luncheon speaker at the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council, so he came into our studio yesterday for a conversation. Congressman Leach, if we could spend the hour looking outward to the challenges abroad facing the president-elect, and also I'd like to get your views on the state of our democracy and our election system, since that's also been in the news and of concern to a great number of people. The title of your luncheon address is Post-Election Perspectives for International Relations, so I wonder if we could start there. Still several weeks until the inauguration of Donald Trump. But he has the attention of world leaders in Europe, in China, Russia, elsewhere. What are your thoughts on, as you see the president-elect interact with the rest of the world as the president-elect?
Well, there are a lot of uncertainties, and that isn't just about the president-elect. It's about the world. One of the reasons he's was elected is that the world's in a frantic pace of change, and that's discombobulating for citizens of America. It's discombobulating for citizens around the world, and it means that people are questioning establishment, and that happened in this election. It's happening in other countries, and Mr. Trump took advantage of that circumstance. Change always advantages some and disadvantages others. And there are a lot of disadvantaged people in the world.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean by took advantage of that situation?
Well, there are an awful lot of Americans that feel the establishment let them down, that events in recent years have been imperfect. After all, we are still involved in our two longest wars and arguably our two most debilitating psychologically. That is, we've had other wars that have been far more intense with the number of people injured, et cetera. But the psychological aspects of these wars where people are killed by roadside bombs, where people are killed by small kids carrying a device of some nature into a group of people. This is the type of war we're not used to, and it's really awkward. It's also a war that's been triggered by religious differentiations, and that again is different for America. We have largely, although obviously not fully, but we've largely gotten over huge religious differentiations in this country in terms of can people live together. Other parts of the world have not, and we see a situation we're involved where there are civil wars based on religion and where these religious-based wars also are acting out against other religions. And so, It's an unhappy circumstance. We also had a man-made recession recently, and the establishment is in partial measure responsible for both of these wars and the recession. And so the country was in a mood for change. But now, in terms of that change, it wasn't clear exactly where the president-elect was going. The principal exception was he was going to build a wall. And so that was understood by all Americans. He made a few promises on issues, but not very many. In fact, Mrs. Clinton very professionally laid out a rather large docket of issues. Mr. Trump established a more convincing for the majority of people who voted in enough states of basically large senses of feelings and senses of going in a different direction, even though it was not clear exactly where that direction would lead. Mm-hmm. Now, the world is bifurcating analogously the way America is. That is, we are seeing more splits in this country than we've seen in recent years. And the world is seeing more splits. And so we have a somewhat splintered America dealing with an increasingly splintered world environment. And you can have and see phenomenal changes occurring in Russia. You can see challenges in China. You can see challenges in several parts of the Middle East. And then with the understanding that any part of the Middle East could surprisingly erupt at any time. Mm-hmm. And then you have the problems that are universal of the environment. And they are serious. And the question of what is the meaning of science when it applies to a subject like the environment. You have issues of whether or not it's wise for a country to try to go it alone, or whether there's a role for alliances, whether there's a role for trade agreements. And trade agreements are nothing less than expanding international law in a economic arena. And is it wise to have general principles, or is it better to say, let's just operate in the economic term, and it hasn't been used in many, many years. It's called autarky, and autarky means self-reliance on everything. And is that better for a country, or is it worse for a country? And these are big questions that the president-elect appears to have some instincts about. He hasn't well laid out his plans. He's putting together a cabinet that has some controversy surrounding his nominees and some less so.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a look at, have you comment on one of the designated cabinet members that has been recently named, Exxon's CEO Rex Tillerson. Some lawmakers worrying about his links to Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, worrying about opposition that he has to U.S. sanctions on Russia put in place because of the annexation of part of the Ukraine, Crimea, and the fact that Rex Tillerson was awarded a friendship medal in 2013 by Russia. Do you share those concerns, or do you buy the argument, why not have a friend in Russia, someone who has worked with Russia for decades in his position as a part of a global oil company?
Well, I prefer to look at it as an open question. And the reason I say this is I do not think it's inappropriate to have a businessman that's mature and understands world trade. That is, as a premise, okay. What is awkward is whether there are conflicts of interest. And what is further awkward is whether those conflicts of interest involve attitudes that the majority of Americans may not share. And I think we'll know more after the hearings. And we'll obviously know a lot more that if Mr. Tillerson is confirmed, how he acts in office. Mm-hmm. But I don't think he should be simply dismissed. I think he deserves to be heard, and then make a judgment at that time.
Mm-hmm. What about these sanctions imposed on Russia following its annexation of Crimea? Are you concerned that they would be lifted too easily by Donald Trump?
Well, I'm concerned. It's not the end of the world, but the United States basically and Western Europe had very few tools with which to respond. And one obvious option is to militarily respond. And a military response is one in this situation that would be foolhardy. We don't have forces positioned there. We don't have all sorts of reasoning that you should not use military in that circumstance. Mm-hmm. And so choosing an economic sanction was a way of expressing deep concern about Crimea, also about whether Crimea is a septic zone. And is Crimea about only Crimea, or
exactly.
Is Crimea about Ukraine next, the Baltics afterwards? And these are very serious questions. And so the rationale for putting on sanctions I think was probably quite correct. At some point, sanctions presumably will have to be removed, but that point will be put off if Crimea is used as a stepping stone, and so time will tell.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to have us listen to a little bit of Donald Trump's talk about Vladimir Putin. This is a little excerpt from an interview with Bill O'Reilly on April 28th of 2016, Republican candidate Donald Trump had this to say about Vladimir Putin.
I'm saying that I think I'd possibly have a good relationship. I don't know. I think he said some really nice things. He called me a genius. He said Trump's a genius. Okay. So, you know, that's nice. That's not going to persuade me one way or the other. I had people on the debate stage. They said, get him to disavow it. Get him. I said, why would I do that? But he's been very nice to me. But let me just tell you, I have no idea, Bill. Maybe we will. Maybe we won't. If we can make a great deal for our country and get along with Russia, that would be a tremendous
thing. So you would try
détente. I would love to try it.
You would try it.
I would certainly try.
Okay, so there's Donald Trump in April of 2016. Putin is a leader long viewed by many, the Democratic Party also, and the GOP as a calculating and untrustworthy foe of the United States. But Trump has repeatedly praised his leadership. Do you think Trump be a president that makes a sea change in U.S.-Russian relations, turns Putin into more of an ally than a foe?
Well, Putin has gone through two broad positions. When he came into office initially, he was appeared to be reaching out to the West. And then he shifted gears, and then those gears went into higher gear. He expressed dreams of a reconstituted Great Russia. Now it looks like those expressions of dreams are taking on articulation in a deeper way and with deeds deeper yet. I mean, the invasion of Crimea, the subsequent intrusions into Ukraine are very serious. I've been part of something called the Dartmouth Conference group for since leaving Congress. And the Dartmouth Conference is a private sector group established with the blessings of Dwight David Eisenhower in 1960 that meets every other year, either here or in Russia, to discuss with Russians that are not exactly in the government but are close to leadership, and the American group are not exactly in government but are close to the State Department and other government officials, and each side being about a dozen. And the last two meetings of this group, the Russian side was very firm on expressing a definition of Putin, which is that Putin believes the Cold War is not over. And he holds that kind of disdainfully that it's okay for America to act out in the world in many places, but that we should respect that Russia is a great power and that in their neighborhood we should respect their actions. And translated, that means that Putin wants to bring back within the Russian fold at least some of the former provinces of the Soviet Union. And if you recall, before World War II, Latvia, Lithuania,
Estonia
were independent states, and then they became provinces of the Soviet Union. I personally think the United States could be tested as early as this winter on an action in one or all three of those states. And that kind of thing would put some various serious differences between NATO, the European Union, the United States, and Russia. On the other hand, when you say, are there things that we can get along better with Russia? One might be Syria, where Secretary of State John Kerry has been trying to negotiate a mutual kind of approach, Russia and the United States, within Syria. And at points, it looked like there might be agreement on Russia's side. And then after agreement, Russia has taken kind of a one-sided military approach in Syria, and all on the side of the government in power, a government that we have grave doubts about. And so it's possible that Mr. Trump would be able to reach an agreement with Russia, and that we might, on an equalitarian basis and on a more or less common cause basis, bring greater stability to Syria. Mm-hmm. And when I say possible, I don't mean probable. I just mean it's possible.
But back to your point, if I could, where you say that it's possible that the U.S. under Trump would be tested as early as this winter during the campaign in the Baltic states. Donald Trump often questioned the value of the NATO alliance. He called it obsolete. He suggested that the U.S. might not come to the aid of NATO countries in a time of crisis if they weren't paying their fair share. It sounds to me like you're saying that the Baltic states should be very concerned that they will be pulled back into control of Russia.
Well, I personally am exceptionally concerned about that. And I'm exceptionally concerned about rhetoric suggesting that. What Trump is, however, reflecting is the attitude of not the attitude, but the realism of many members of NATO, not necessarily the United States. It would be very hard to convince European countries to send troops in an active engagement against Russia in the Baltic states. And that is a true challenge to NATO because it is a mutual defense security treaty. But Russia has a huge advantage. They neighbor Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. NATO countries do not. And they are poised with enormous conventional force capacity. Now, one of the things that Putin is doing, he is naval maneuvers, army maneuvers, and in the region, and he is also seemingly every two or three weeks mentioning nuclear weapons. Now, I personally put very little weight behind the likelihood that he would be prepared to use nuclear weapons, but one reason for raising him is that it underscores that in a world of mutually assured destruction, the United States is unlikely to use nuclear weapons against Russia if they invaded the Baltic states, and therefore you have a circumstance that you're dealing with conventional warfare. And Do we have half a million troops stationed right outside the Baltic states? And we don't. And that is the means that many of the Europeans are certainly going to be suggesting that we ought to be looking at economic sanctions rather than military sanctions.
Mm-hmm. So if Putin, under some reasoning, moves into the Baltic states, the European countries, the U.S., would not have much of an option other than applying sanctions, you're saying?
Well, I don't think the United States should give up sanctions. I mean, it should give up options. But in your own mind, you can make your own judgment whether that would be a wise thing to do. But I do not think in any way whatsoever should we suggest in advance that we would not move.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about how you see the U.S. relationship to the European Union changing in the next 4 years, or the circumstance that President-elect Trump faces with our partnership with the Europeans?
Well, this is a very awkward situation. Mr. Trump decided to enter the discussions on the so-called Brexit issue, whether Britain should get out, and which Britain, in a referendum, has chosen to do by a very, very narrow margin. After all, the polls had indicated that the judgment would be different than the one that came into being. This has not pleased the British. And we have a circumstance that two countries in the world seem to be pleased to have Trump as president, and one is Russia and one is China. Virtually the entirety of the European governments are really rather nonplussed with the outcome of the American election. But that doesn't mean that there aren't some forces within Europe that aren't sympathetic to Mr. Trump. In fact, there are several forces that are quite analogous to Mr. Trump, and they may come to power in their country, such as in France. But we're in a really, really incredible world. And this does not mean that Mrs. Clinton, if she'd been elected, wouldn't be facing some of the same traumas. These are not traumas that only Mr. Trump is bringing upon the country in terms of decision-making, but he might not be the person one citizen would prefer, and he might be the exact person someone else would.
You're listening to my conversation with Congressman Jim Leach. He served as a Republican member of the U.S. House of Representatives from Iowa for 30 years, from 1977 to 2007, a widely respected politician, scholar, now at the University of Iowa. He has a wealth of expertise in international relations. When we come back, we'll continue to talk about the international relations that the president-elect will be facing. We'll also talk about election integrity here at home. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. With more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, listening back to a conversation I had yesterday with former Congressman Jim Leach. Leach served our state in the U.S. House of Representatives for 30 years with his wealth of international expertise. During his time in Congress, he was a senior member of the House Committee on International Relations. After being defeated in 2007 by Democrat Dave Loebsack, he served in other positions, including chair of the National Endowment for the Humanities, as well as serving on the faculty at Harvard and Princeton universities. Currently, he serves in several capacities at the University of Iowa, chair in public affairs, visiting professor of law, senior scholar, and also interim director of the University of Iowa Museum of Art. In the first part of our talk, I asked Jim Leach about the challenges abroad that will face President-elect Donald Trump. In this second part, I asked him for his thoughts about the tumultuous 2016 campaign and election and about the convention-busting approach of Donald Trump. Let's go back to that conversation I had with Jim Leach, recorded yesterday. In the last few days, Congressman, President-elect Trump, the nation's intelligence agencies, the two major parties, have become embroiled in a dispute over what evidence exists that Russia's president moved beyond mere espionage to deliberately trying to subvert our democracy to pick the winner of the presidential election. What do you see as the implications of what we're seeing unfold?
Well, it's quite unsettling. On this kind of issue, I have a great deal of respect for the CIA, and I do not think that they would make a set of assertions if they did not have a very powerful case. I'm impressed that several members of the Republican leadership of the Senate have called for hearings on the subject with the implication that they think the issue ought to be looked at in a very nonpartisan way. Clearly, Mr. Trump has his own views. I think they're probably a minority in Washington.
What do you think of his stated position that we can't know who was behind it when many intelligence agencies here, and you've been briefed by many intelligence agencies of the United States, they have a consensus that the Russians were involved. Now the CIA is saying they were putting the thumb on the scale for Donald Trump. The other ones are not. But the fact that the incoming president is very skeptical about his own intelligence, what are your thoughts there?
Oh, I think this is all very understandable, Ben. The president-elect obviously does not want it thought that the Russians aided his reelection bid. And one can make up their own judgment of whether they did or didn't, but I doubt if it tipped the election. But I do think the likelihood is that the Russians did prefer Mr. Trump. And that's just something Mr. Trump should live with, but that it isn't the end of the world.
Mm-hmm. Investigations have been announced, bipartisan investigations. Mm-hmm. We'll see what form they take. What in particular will you be watching as these investigations are planned and go forward? What's important here that be investigated and how it be investigated?
Well, I think you want an investigation unlike the one that related to Libya that seemed to be starkly partisan. And on events and issues that seem to be blown out of proportion. In this case, the issue is deeply serious. This is a foreign country trying to affect the outcome of the most important election in the United States. And so every American, doesn't matter whether they were for Mr. Trump, for Mrs. Clinton, Republican, Democrat, whatever, should be alarmed. That this is a model that should not be allowed to repeat. And so in many ways, there are two aspects to this. One aspect is simply, should a foreign power tamper in our circumstance and what ramifications should follow? And the second is it's important to know just how they did it because one wants to know how to block it in the future. And so this is a incredibly important inquiry that should be commenced.
Let's turn our focus to talk about U.S.-China relations, if we could, Congressman. In the past few days, Beijing has warned the incoming U.S. administration that any attempt to challenge the one China policy could affect peace in the Taiwan Strait. The Chinese also say interference may also damage developing U.S.-China relations. However, the president-elect, Donald Trump, has expressed doubts about continuing to abide by that policy. He said a few days ago the U.S. did not necessarily have to stick with its longstanding position that Taiwan is part of one China. Trump, we remember from a few days ago, angered China by taking a phone call from Taiwan's president and then tweeting about it. In a conversation, let's listen to a bit of Donald Trump. In a conversation with Fox News host Chris Wallace on Sunday, the president-elect responded this way after being asked about his phone call to Taiwan.
I don't know why we have to be bound by a one China policy unless we make a deal with China, having to do with other things, including trade. I mean, look, we're being hurt very badly by China with devaluation, with taxing us heavy at the borders when we don't tax them, with building a massive fortress in the middle of the South China Sea, which they shouldn't be doing, and frankly, with not helping us at all with North Korea. You have North Korea, you have nuclear weapons, and China could solve that problem, and they're not helping us at all. So I don't want China dictating to me.
Okay, so what are your thoughts about Donald Trump's putting the one China policy in question here?
Well, some of the problems he's raised are valid in terms of what China's doing in the South China Sea, but raising the one China policy is potentially the most counterproductive position the United States government could conceivably take. In all parts of the world, but one, the concept of independence and self-determination are virtually synonymous. With Taiwan, they're juxtaposed. And what I mean by this is, if Taiwan declares independence, it will have no self-determination because the Chinese will attack quickly and overwhelmingly. If they keep the current status, they will have a great deal of self-determination. And what will jeopardize it is if the United States says they're an independent country. When they are whole basis of approving relations with China under President Nixon, and it's written out in very careful framework, was that we recognize that Taiwan was an integral part of China, but we would object to any change in the governance structure in China by use of force. And this has been the foreign policy of the last eight administrations, beginning with that of Mr. Nixon through that of the current one, Mr. Obama. It included Ronald Reagan, it included George H.W. Bush, it included George W. Bush. Indeed, I once carried a note from George W. Bush to the president of Taiwan saying, knock off the independence racket.
What year was that?
It would have been in the, give or take a year or two, 2004, but don't hold me to the precise year,
all
please.
Right.
The United States of America has a very powerful force called the Seventh Fleet in the region. The Chinese have over 1,000 missiles that can knock out almost anything in the straits between Taiwan and China. That doesn't mean all missiles will get through, but it's pretty hard to stop them all.
Mm-hmm. So in the case of a military confrontation,
in the case
the
of
US,
military,
yeah, the U.S. forces would be?
The U.S. forces would be highly jeopardized. They're very formidable, though, but they would be highly jeopardized.
Let me just remind our listeners that I'm speaking this hour with Jim Leach, former Congressman Jim Leach, representing Iowa for 30 years in the U.S. Congress, talking to him about the post-election perspectives for international relations. Let's talk about Iran, specifically the nuclear deal reached between Iran and six world powers last year. Lately, Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu has resumed his attacks on that nuclear deal with Iran, apparently seeking Donald Trump's help to undo this cornerstone of the Obama administration's foreign policy legacy. On this past Sunday, Netanyahu said on CBS's 60 Minutes, there are various ways of undoing last year's accord. We know that Donald Trump is no fan of the deal under which Tehran agreed to suspend a suspected push to develop nuclear weapons in return for lifting of most of the sanctions against it. During the campaign, Donald Trump called the pact a disaster. Also, in his words, the worst deal ever negotiated. What are your thoughts here, and what happens if the U.S. under Trump backs out of this deal with the Iranians, with also keeping in mind that other world powers are on board as well here?
Well, there's one fundamental way of looking at this. In one sense, one can take either position as quite reasonable, either to have the agreement or not to have the agreement initially. But once the agreement was made, the situation changes. And this particular agreement, more precisely than almost any other agreement, because the obligations of the U.S. were up front in terms of transferring resources to Iran. And I want to be clear, the resources transferred were funds of the Iranian government that we had locked up because of our differences with them, but they belong to the Iranian government. We never claimed them. And so we're basically, in this agreement, have returned large sums of money. And return, Iran has agreed not to do certain things in developing nuclear weapons. At this stage, if you throw the agreement out, we will have given them everything, and they will not have to follow through on their obligations. What could be more foolish?
What's keeping them to holding their obligations now that they have their money back? Supposing we hold to this agreement.
Well, partly we can isolate them more comprehensively economically. But the main point is they've got new resources that we have acknowledged belong to them to begin with. And in return for them keeping the deal, we can continue this way. Now, if they break this deal, if we break the deal, they can do anything we want. If we don't break the deal, then we watch them. And if they then break the deal, we have every reason to respond in a given way. But if they don't break the deal, that's good for us. And so why would we pull out when henceforth 95% of the obligations are all on the Iranians? There's no reason for us to pull out. Now, you can say we shouldn't have made that agreement. We shouldn't have followed through in our part of the agreement. But that's past. And new presidents have to come in and deal with the circumstances they have. And let me make an analogy. Barack Obama, as I, strongly opposed the Iraq War. But when he became president, he had to deal with the situation that was then in play. And so he didn't instantly pull out the troops. He has been tied down in Iraq, and partly by things that have happened in Iraq and Syria, principally around ISIS. But he had to deal with the situation he was dealt. And you and I might say ISIS would never have formed if America didn't attack Iraq. You and I can say maybe it was a mistake to attack Iraq. But once Obama became president, he had to deal with the mistake. And he can't ignore the decisions that had been made by the prior president. And there's a little bit of analogy here. Trump might have been right that we shouldn't have made the deal with Iran. That's a possibility. But I think he's dead wrong to pull out at this stage.
in the 10 minutes or so we have remaining, let's talk about Donald Trump's aversion that we've seen in the last few days to intelligence briefings. In Congress, Congressman Leach, you were a senior member of the House Committee on International Relations, I assume, received a great number of intelligence briefings. Trump is receiving an average of one presidential intelligence briefing a week, far fewer than most of his recent predecessors. In a conversation with Fox News host Chris Wallace on Sunday, Trump defended his decision to forego daily intelligence briefings, opting instead to attend them once a week.
Well, I get it when I need it.
But is there some skepticism?
First of all, these are very good people that are giving me the briefings. And I say, if something should change from this point, immediately call me. I'm available on 1 minute's notice. I don't have to be told, you know, I'm like a smart person. I don't have to be told the same thing and the same words every single day for the next 8 years.
Congressman, can Trump's aversion to daily intelligence briefings last? We're several weeks away from him taking office.
Well, every president has a different personality and a different judgment of their own knowledge. I can't think of anyone who needs an education more in some of the subtleties of international relations than the president-elect for the position he's about to hold. And so I would personally urge him to be open to the briefings. Now, obviously, he has a huge amount on his plate right now about putting our government together. And obviously, that government will have people in it who have quite a background, and they will be receiving various intelligence briefings. And so to some degree, he will be getting information from his other people and his appointees, although they're not in office yet. But I would have to say a president has a right to not be heard or not listen, but this is a time that listening about the subtleties of international relations is pretty important.
Before we end this conversation, I'd like to have you give us your thoughts. Many in this country concerned about our election process. What are your thoughts about how this election was run and what it's done to the integrity of our election process?
Well, there are kind of two elements of this question. I mean, was it an honest election? Was the voting fair and square, et cetera? And my view is absolutely. With a few imperfections, but imperfections that are relatively small. Then there's the issue of was this election of a kind that this country should be proud? Was the rhetoric appropriate? Was this high-minded? Was it uplifting? And the answer to that is it was appalling. And this is one of the most interesting and at the same time appalling elections in American history, where concepts of big lies were told and repeated, and where ethics was not perfect on either side. And I personally was very chagrined by the way the candidates set themselves forth. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I preserve the right to a secret ballot, but I want to be very open. I thought Mrs. Clinton was right that this was time for a woman to command the White House, and therefore I wrote in Mary Sue Coleman, the former president of the University of Iowa, is my candidate for president.
Did you really?
I surely did. And I thought that Mr. Trump was exactly right, that a businessman would bring some new kinds of energy to the White House. So for vice president, I wrote in John Papajohn, who I consider to be Iowa's leading citizen today, who is an immensely successful businessman, but one who's led the state in giving great gifts to higher education and to the arts. And I thought that would be a terrific team.
I wonder, before we go, can you imagine Donald Trump in some year's time being recognized, based on what we know about him right now, being recognized as a great president?
Well, that is one question that all of us must say only time will tell, that we all have a vested interest that this be a successful presidency. Every one of us does.
I guess I'm asking, can you imagine that?
I can imagine that as a possibility. I would not say it's a high possibility.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jim Leach, Congressman Jim Leach, for coming into our studio today. Currently chair in public affairs, visiting professor of law, senior scholar at the University of Iowa, and the newest title, interim director of the University of Iowa Museum of Art. Thank you very much, Congressman Leach.
Thank you, Ben.
And that concludes a conversation I had with Congressman Jim Leach yesterday. Today, he is the luncheon speaker at the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council. So he came into our studio yesterday for the conversation you just heard. He spoke before the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council about post-election perspectives for international relations. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Kevin Perkins is our executive producer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.